Coming up on Tech News Today, apparently a Microsoft Xbox announcement's coming soon. Google Fiber pretty much certain to be coming to Austin, Texas. And Sony brings the price of 4K TV down. Anybody want it, though? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, April 8th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why we love our cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Buy one desk phone, get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 of the day in the news fuse. The Verge reports Motico.com has leaked a pre-release version of Facebook Home, the new app for Android that takes over your home and lock screen and integrates in all the Facebook goodness. Facebook announced the app would only work on 5 phones, but Motico says they've got it working on a wide range of devices, including the Nexus 4 phone and the Nexus 7 tablet. Simply allow install from unknown sources in the settings, and apparently you're on your way. Mileage may vary.
Telecom equipment maker Ericsson has announced it's acquiring Microsoft's Media Room IPTV business, which makes software that allows operators to deliver television over the internet. Rumors about this started at the end of last month, came from Bloomberg initially. Microsoft took to its blog as well, saying that the acquisition is mutually beneficial and strategically aligned for both parties.
HTC reported some financials, and things aren't so great for the company. Its profit was down 98% compared to last year. Yikes. The company was hit hard due to the delayed launch of its new flagship phone, the HTC One. HTC's net profit was about $2.8 million, which is its lowest quarterly net profit since 2006.
Win Supersites' Paul Theriot, host of Windows Weekly right here on Twit, and The Verge both agree Microsoft will announce details of its next game console on May 21st in advance of E3, which isn't until June 11th, so they've got about a month jump on E3 by doing this announcement. Theriot said the event was originally scheduled for April 24th, but was moved. The Verge reports the event will be small, with the first details announced, and then reserving the big unveil for E3. Paul also added he hears the console will be around $500 with a $300 annual Xbox Live subscription and must be internet connected to use.
Deal with it. Live in California?
Yes.
Drive a lot?
Yeah, I do.
Sometimes.
Yeah? All right. Well, now you can be pulled over for using your GPS while driving.
I have it.
The state's current ban on texting while driving has been expanded via an appellate court. California versus Spriggs has argued that the distraction would be present whether the wireless telephone was being used as a telephone, a GPS navigator, a clock, or a device for sending and receiving texts and emails.
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office withdrew some of its concerns over Apple's trademark application for the iPad mini. Originally, the USPTO issued a statement saying the word mini may not be subject to trademark as it is merely descriptive. The new position by the office is that Apple would be required to display a disclaimer when it uses the word mini that says no claim is made to the exclusive right to use mini apart from the mark as shown. If Apple doesn't do that, the USPTO may refuse to register the entire mark.
Does the disclaimer have to be the same type and font as everything else? Because that would make
it
the box
hilarious. It did not specify.
Friday evening, Google announced that they would make an announcement in conjunction with the city of Austin on Tuesday at 11 a.m. Central Time. Austin's KVUTV and VentureBeat both reported almost immediately that the announcement would in fact be Google Fiber Internet coming to the live music capital of the world. And Gadget reported a reader spotted a post on Google Fiber's blog at 3 a.m. Saturday morning titled Google Fiber's Next Stop, Austin, Texas, with some dummy text. That post has since disappeared, but looks like we know what they're going to announce.
Does Austin really call itself the live music capital of the world, or is that
it does call itself that? Yes.
Well, that's nice. Sony's got pricing and a release date for its new 4K LED televisions, and now the company has announced more details about its 4K FMP X1 media player coming out of NAB. The device looks like what Sony showed off at CES in January, and will be available sometime this summer for $699. The FMP X1 will be bundled with 10 films. Including Bad Teacher, the remake of The Karate Kid, and Taxi Driver.
Ars Technica's Nate Anderson reports that an ISP seems to be injecting its own ads onto every web page it serves to its subscribers. Robert Silvey and PhD student Zach Henkel both described discovering code in pages accessed with a connection from CMA Communications that routed ads from a service called Route 66, spelled R66T. After Anderson contacted CMA, their terms of service suddenly changed on April 4th to describe a digital layer of information provided by Route 66 and requiring users to waive their right to sue.
According to Digital Trends, Google is currently in negotiation to buy WhatsApp for somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion.
Ooh.
The talk started 4 or 5 weeks ago, and apparently WhatsApp is playing hardball with Google and is looking to get even more money than Google's offering. WhatsApp is a messaging app that lets its users send text, audio, video, and images to each other.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Ring Central. When we built the Twit Studios, one of the things we didn't want to have to do was spend a lot of money on telephone equipment, but we still needed telephones at the desks for a lot of people for the workplace. So the solution was easy. When Russell, our IT guy, said, do it in the cloud, we were like, what does that mean? He said, get Ring Central. It's in the cloud. It's a no-brainer. We love Ring Central. Zero startup costs. No PBX hardware to install or maintain. Don't know what PBX hardware is? Don't worry about it. You don't need to know. It's just costly, and it takes up a lot of space. Get Ring Central. It allows you to easily customize all your call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail and their email, and we even get all our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user, and you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial and a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So do this right now. Call this number, 800-543-9980. That's designated for our listeners, 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980, or go to ringcentral.com and use promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com. Promo code TWIT. We thank RingCentral for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now, we also thank for his support of Tech News Today, Ewan Rankin, the Prime Minister of the British Tech Network. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome. How are you doing, sir?
It's good to have you, man. I hear you threw out your back. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, old man injury, though. I'm fine.
Well, you can lie down during the show. It's totally fine.
Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. Let's start off talking about Microsoft's plan to focus on Xbox. They did sell the Media Room IPTV business. Sarah, tell us about that.
Yeah, they sold it to Ericsson. Both parties have released statements saying that this is mutually beneficial, as I mentioned in the news fuse. And Media Room, if you're kind of like, what is Media Room? It's an IPTV business. It basically lets operators deliver television online over the internet. Media Room powers 22 million set-top boxes in 11 million subscriber households. So now with Ericsson as boss here, will be the leading provider of IPTV and multi-screen solutions. Got a market share of about 25% in its class. And that puts it, Ericsson rather, in a lead position for TV Anywhere consumption. Media Room is used by service providers like AT&T's UVerse, Deutsche Telekom's Entertain, Telefonica, Swisscom. Oh my goodness, somebody's yelling outside. It's based in Mountain View, California, but they've got about 400 employees around the world. What's interesting, though, Tom, and you mentioned in the news fuse, is kind of this Xbox tie-in. Microsoft is kind of like, you know, we are just going to put all of our efforts and all of our resources into Xbox. That's where we want our efforts to be based. And Xbox is, you know, Microsoft's trying to build a cloud TV platform for Xbox. And this whole event that apparently started out as an April 24th event that Microsoft was supposed to be holding to talk about the Xbox now has been pushed to, as Paul Thrott and The Verge are both saying, May 21st, which is still ahead of E3. Ewan, do you think that there's... Do you think that this makes sense? Is there a need for a smaller sort of, let's talk about what's going to be ahead at E3 for the Xbox?
With this, the whole thing about the TV process, I mean, the Windows Media has never worked particularly well unless you've got a Windows Media PC that's transmitting directly to your Xbox. And I'm surprised that the sale of this system, because for a start, it's Silverlight powered, so I'm sure that Xbox, Microsoft aren't giving up their patents on Silverlight for this. And I think the devil's in the detail about what they're actually buying and how much it's going to actually contribute back to the Xbox. I mean, at E3, you'd expect something that's going to be pretty earth-shattering, you'd hope, from Microsoft. The TV element of that has got to be there. So I don't understand selling this bit off right now, unless there's some dual kickback thing, which with both companies saying that they're mutually beneficial. I think that probably is in there.
As over the weekend, actually it was Friday afternoon, we had talked about Adam Orth, who is the Microsoft Studios creative director. So kind of not saying, listen, the next Xbox is going to have an always-on type of a thing, you know, have to be connected to the internet, but was pretty vocal about the fact that people need to get used to the idea. Microsoft issued an apology saying, we're very sorry if this offended anybody, and that he's not a spokesperson for Microsoft, although doesn't really deny anything, just says that that's not the way that Microsoft would communicate directly with our loyal customers.
You would hope the spokesperson wouldn't say, deal with it. That's not the Microsoft way.
Sure, sure. But it's also somewhat curious that Microsoft, it's an apology, but a pretty vague one, too.
There's a good chance the Xbox is going to need an always-on connection anyway. A lot of the thoughts are to avoid piracy. You could authenticate all the games this way. You always are connected. And again, Xbox Live is obviously really beneficial when you have an internet connection. So the idea that Microsoft and Sony both are thinking about having always-on connections on their devices doesn't sound that surprising, considering that's the way things have been going on the PC anyway. So it's likely to happen. I mean, Paul Theroux thinks it, and there's a good chance he's on the ball. He's really good at covering Microsoft stuff. So I'm thinking that Microsoft just wants to control the message better than deal with it. It's going to be like, here you go. And they'll write it in small print somewhere, always on.
Tom, what do you think? Do you think selling off this media room arm to Ericsson makes sense for Microsoft to free up some resources for what their, you know, their core business ends up being?
Yeah, I think it could. And I think that that $300 service charge that Paul Theroux mentioned might be coming down the pike points to where we're going here. What Microsoft is betting on is that the future is actually internet TV, not IPTV. They're saying, look, we tried the Ultimate TV as a competitor to TiVo back in the day. That didn't work. We've actually turned that into a decently profitable business selling cable boxes to set-top boxes to cable companies. That business is dying. That's what Microsoft seems to be saying here. We're going to put all bets on internet television over a console, and we've been trying to make Xbox that console for a long time. So if anything justifies a $300 a year Xbox Live account, it's some beefed up entertainment service, probably television, movies, music, and your video games all combined in one. That's going to be a big pitch because that's a big price hike that they're talking about. But if, remember, they've partnered up with cable companies on the Xbox. So if they can provide some sort of internet-only aspect of that, or maybe some partnerships with somebody like an HBO where you get some internet-only television that's part of that Xbox Live subscription, that could be huge, and that could make that suddenly seem like a decent idea. And they're not going to come out and say $300 a year. They're going to divide that by 12, and they're going to make it sound a lot cheaper. That'd be my guess. I just don't understand why they're doing a May 21st announcement.
Yeah, that whole thing is a little odd as well.
Yeah,
what do you announce while still holding back enough so that you don't pre-announce something and take the sales out of, you know, the E3 announcement?
I mean, wouldn't you just say here's our product and here's what you're going to be able to play with at E3? That kind of thing. Try to build a big drive towards that. I'm sure if it's the television aspect, they might be announcing partners, and then, yeah, you actually want to play the thing? We'll have it ready, as opposed to Sony's, hey, we got a box, and nobody can use it.
Yeah, and there's no box. Because that Major Nelson made a big deal about the fact that Sony didn't show you the actual box. So we'll see if Microsoft does. All right, let's talk a little bit about this Google Fiber. I think people are a little surprised that we hadn't heard any leaks, because you need a lot of governmental approval if you want to go into a city and start rolling out fiber. But it looks like, for sure, based on all these leaks that happened since Friday, that's what we're going to see. I asked, why do you think they picked Austin? Kansas City was sort of a surprising pick because it isn't considered a big tech hub. Are they going the opposite way? Austin has a ton of tech companies.
You know, I've never been to Austin. I know very little about it. And so I had to look it up this morning. I'm like, what's big about this town that would bring Google over? It does have a pretty large population, over 800,000 people.
Live music capital of the world.
That's what they say. And they're called the Silicon Hills as well. They have a bunch of nicknames. There are tons of tech companies that have bases there. So I'm thinking if Google wants to go into Austin, it would be a major push because Kansas City has something like 150,000 people. This has 800,000. If they can scale to a large city, now this isn't necessarily saying that Google is going to cover the entire city in fiber, but if they could, 800,000 people could be a great thing for Google to say, yeah, we can hook this up almost anywhere because this big town can support it.
And what do you think about that idea of hooking it up almost anywhere? Ewan, I mean, do you see Google becoming an ISP, doing this in a bunch of cities, maybe bringing it, you know, across the ocean to you guys over there in England?
I'd love to think that Google was going to give fiber to the door to the entire world one city at a time, but I think Birmingham would be pretty well down on the list by the time it gets to us. It'd be nice. I mean, the question is the pricing and that kind of stuff, because a lot of the ISP stuff here in the UK certainly initially is subsidised to get you into the process. And then it's where do you monetize from there if you're not charging enough to cover the overhead from the first place? And Google aren't going to be sending ads down to cover the cost of their ISP setup. So, again, it depends on the price and it depends where they see the revenue coming back in or whether it's one of these egalitarian things that they're looking just to break even on it. But, yeah, I'll have it. Give it me. We've got 120 megabits a second over here. So, you know, we're okay for speed. It's not too bad.
Austin, to me, seems like a really good fit for this. You know, again, it's... Kansas City is a much smaller city than Austin, and not necessarily the city that people say, tech hub. But Austin really is. There are a lot of not only large companies that are based out of Austin, but it has a thriving startup scene, you know, outside of South by Southwest, where people come in from other places, you know, to communicate with each other, you know, and the tech scene. And, you know, it's a large city, but it's not massive. You've got under a million people, at least in the metropolitan area. And I think that this is a you know, Google's not just picking Austin out of a hat. This is a city that is going to not only appreciate something like Google Fiber, but you could probably see some really interesting statistics and early results as far as how it's going to change the scene that's already there. I mean, we've seen it in Kansas City already, but Austin already has that thriving tech presence, exactly.
Matt in the chat room saying...
Go ahead, Ewan.
Sorry, I was just saying, Matt in the chat room saying, didn't Austin apply for the testbed position that Kansas City initially got? So this could be a kind of fallback.
Right, the miscongeniality of winning the Google Fiber auction. You get a second.
Something like that.
Yeah. By the size of the metro areas are actually very similar. Austin has a population of 800,000, as Ayaz pointed out, and Kansas City only has 400,000, but metro area for Kansas City is 2.1 million, and it's 1.8 million for Austin. So scale-wise, this may be a similar thing where they can say, well, we know how to roll out in that kind of area, but usage-wise is going to be a lot different because whereas Kansas City benefited by saying, hey, startups, now you can come to Kansas City. We have a small community, but it can get bigger. Austin already has a big community, and so that's going to stress that network out a little more. I think for what Sarah said, though, it makes a really good choice. It makes a very logical choice, and I think that perhaps, I don't know, my neighborhood would be a good third choice. Let's move on to Sony, bringing the cost of 4K TVs down. They're certainly not bargains, but what did they announce at NAB, Ayaz?
Compared to the 84-inch, $25,000 TVs, these do sound like a bargain. Sony announced some pricing of some of its televisions it showed off at CES. There's a 55-inch 4K TV. It's going to cost $6,000. The 65-inch model is going to cost $7,000. And this is the pricing was today. Both are going to be available online and retail on the 21st of April. And then Sony also announced that 4K media player that Sarah mentioned, the FMPX1, which I think stands for freaking media player, X1, which will run you about $700. Comes with those 10 movies, a really odd collection of those things. The 4K movie service that this device will be able to stream content from won't be available till the fall. The service, Sony says the service is going to have movies from Sony Pictures and other notable production houses. So didn't mention any particulars on that, but that's what the Surface is going to have. And Sony Electronics president Phil Molyneux already told The Verge back in February that the PS4 would be able to access that media streaming service. Do you understand the point of this FMP X1 player? Why would anybody want to get this at the price of $700?
Well, $700 I think is probably a keen price for something that's going to play 4K. What you get in the media in the format, in terms of whether it's going to be able to come down the pipe fast enough, is debatable. The TVs, from what I understood, 4K is kind of pointless under 80 inches. So 55 and 65-inch models doesn't really make a great deal of difference to your viewing pleasure compared to standard HD.
Sorry, that low price isn't going to get you in the door. $6,000, you're like, oh, well, that's not so bad. I'm going to buy the 84-inch one for $25,000.
Yeah, no.
Oh, man, I'd pay $7,000 to watch Cameron Diaz in Bad Teacher on his own. What a list of movies.
It's a strange collection. Oh. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, what they had rights to or whatever.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Out of the gate. Total Recall, the remake. $6,000 is still way too much, I think, for a vast majority of people who are in the market for new TVs. But yeah, it's starting to get to the point where you're like, oh, okay, we're in the single digits as far as television prices. I'm a little confused, though. If the PS4 can access the same content, at least in the near future, why do I want this 4K media player as well? Why don't they just want to push PS4s that much more?
The only thing I could think of is that this is bundled with those movies, and the PlayStation 4 probably won't be, but 10 movies that are going to be...
They're not that compelling.
Is there any set of movies that Sony could have put together? If they gave you the whole Bond collection, or they gave you all the Spider-Man movies, or all of these things, when does this price actually become worthwhile? Because I was looking at the competition. I was like, what exactly has 4K content? And there was this Red Ray player from Red that makes those awesome 4K cameras, but it costs like $1,500 and uses a proprietary format, and they don't have any movies either. So this kind of concept of where else can you go? $700 sounded crazy in a vacuum to me, but looking up for other content, where else are you going to even get this content? Because I don't think anything can play that. What do you think, Tom?
I think you've got to look at the...
Oh, no, that's all right. I'm just going to say this is an early adopter thing. This is for people who have a lot of disposable income, want to be the first on their block. $700 is cheap. And then maybe in their home theater setup, a gaming console just isn't done, right? They want something that is, you know, more sophisticated, more home theater-like. And so they go for something like this. Ewan, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, if you look at the list of films that are there, you've got Bridge on the River Kwai and Taxi Driver were shot in at least 35mm, if not better. So they're the only ones that are going to scale to 4K anyway. I can't believe that Bad Teacher was shot in 4K. It's going to be shot in 1080 probably and upscaled, or 2.5K and upscaled. And the others, Total Recall, again, I don't believe that was probably shot in 4K. So these are all probably, I don't want to get sued, but I would have said that they were upscales.
They might have done, though. I mean, they might have used a Red camera and shot 4K and then edited down from that. It's not impossible.
Karate Kid 2010 with the Red?
Well, they could have shot it on film, which is unusual still in this day and age, but then you scan it at a higher res, just like you can take a print from a really old movie from 35mm. But I don't see the point of this just yet, because I was looking at the price. $6,000 doesn't sound so bad for a TV anymore, but what are you going to watch on it?
Yeah.
There's like one network in the whole world that shows live video in 4K, unless you want to have four 1080p images up at one time, like if you're ADD like me. Like,
well, and Ewan makes a good point. It's like, that's for a 55-inch television. I have a 55-inch television right now, and the HD is pretty good. I can't get back far enough, you know, for it to make much of a, or I guess close, really, for it to make much of a difference. You need a bigger TV and a bigger space for 4K to wow you, you know, for TVs to kind of be side by side where you say, wow, HD really is not good anymore.
Unless you're going to be doing a lot of picture-in-picture or zooming in or something, right? And that's why this is early adopter stuff. We were having the exact same conversation about HD TVs in 2003 because the prices were about the same, the amount of content was about the same, and this is just, to me, it's just the natural process that the product cycle goes through. And in 10 years, everybody will have 4K TVs. They'll be kicking around all over the place.
I mean, Harrods have got an 80-inch 4K TV there, and that looks phenomenal, but it's £28,000. So the prices are very keen here. I think it's just whether you're going to get the benefit of looking at, as Sarah says there, a 55-inch TV that's playing 4K. I don't think you'll see an enormous enough difference to make you go, wow.
Sarah's got a story about two emerging trends meeting. Software-defined networking, which is an enterprise-level thing you may or may not have heard about. Probably not. But HP you've heard of, and you've heard about how they need a new way forward. And they've got a new server product today that might just be that way forward. What's this about, Sarah?
Yeah, so this is something that HP has been talking about for a while. Project Moonshot was announced 16 months ago. And Meg Whitman, CEO of HP, of course, has talked about this as a major source for new growth a handful of times since then. What HP is doing is going to commercially release a new kind of server. It uses low-power Intel chips. HP says it really saves a lot of energy, 89% less energy used. It's 80% smaller than the typical server that people would, you know, when you think of servers today. Also going to cost 23% as much overall, so a savings. And HP is partnering with many chip suppliers. So we've got Intel, you've got AMD, Applied Materials, Texas Instruments, making low-power chips that normally would be used in mobile phones. This is all was revealed at an event in New York where HP was showing off this machine. Also, and this is kind of interesting, we talk so much about product cycles and how that industry seems to be, you know, being shook up in a variety of different companies, says that they're going to make new versions of these servers once every 3 to 6 months. So they're going to get off of a yearly cycle, which is what most people, you know, equate with server advancements. They're shaped like cartridges, the servers themselves. They snap into enclosures. Servers will have different performance characteristics. So it's sort of like pick and choose type of a thing based on what a company needs. And then if you're a big company, you're a customer, you've got a large data center, you can kind of mix and match your servers to suit the needs of your business and your consumers. It's interesting, too. David Donatelli, who's the GM of HP's server and storage and networking business, says, we sold more than 12 billion of our older servers in 2012. So this is not like a completely new thing where the model is completely turned on its head. He says sales and volume of the new versions will probably start in 2014, and the change is underway. So we're in a transition period. As to me, this seems like, hey, you know, it's more power efficient, makes more sense. You've got servers that suit the needs of your customers that much more. Is this going to save HP? Do you think that they've got something going on here?
Yeah, being a part of the infrastructure of all the cloud computing and everything else that's going on the internet, it's an intelligent play. HP's done a ton of stuff on enterprise. They've done things with servers for the longest time. So the idea that they are coming out with something they can rev consistently and then also have a way to make those revisions, and then the people who bought into it don't have to replace every piece because these are modules or cartridges. So you have this effectively, not a future-proofing, but it's almost like HP's figuring out, okay, we need to make sure that everybody's buying our products on a consistent way. And if we're running the backbone, we're running the infrastructure of everything, that's really helpful because what else could you do? The consumer side, they're really trying, but maybe they're not getting the message across there. They can probably appeal to enterprise and servers a lot easier.
Ewan, I know the topic of servers, you know, I don't know how often you think about servers and enclosures and how many cartridges can fit into, you know, one in a server farm somewhere, but this makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is just a smarter way to run a server business, isn't it?
I think the devil here is definitely looking at whether they live up to the hype or not of what they're actually saying here, whether it actually delivers at what it says. But if it does, I think this could be a very, you know, almost a killer blow. I spend a lot of time working for multinational firms as a photographer, but they're running projects. And the big problem that they've got with projects is how to set up temporary servers for 3 to 6 month durations at locations, get it to function, collapse, take it down again afterwards. And you end up with them virtually, you know, someone has a computer that they then set up to try and file handle, and then someone has to dump that back to the main servers afterwards. If they can create microservers that people can set up and move around very easily, that's the way that business is going, particularly in the projects market. If you also look at large multinationals, they've got divisions, and those divisions have been broken down into smaller and smaller business units, and they're hiring smaller and smaller premises for 10 to 20 to 30 people. So something that's a microserver that can be set up very easily, administered very easily, maybe remote administered, and provide those people with server access to the main systems, as I think is an absolute masterstroke on their part, if it does what it says it does. That's the key problem.
I think when you look at this in conjunction with the other announcement HP is part of today with Cisco and Juniper Networks about Open Daylight, which is an open source software-defined networking platform. It's kind of a piece alongside of something like Hadoop. This shows that HP is finally getting out in front of a trend before they fall to it, unlike with their consumer market where they seem to have been behind the eight ball. Even though they tried to get into tablets, it just didn't work. Now they're teaming up with the big guys to fight off things like Project Floodlight, which is smaller companies and another open source project, saying, you know what, we need to make sure we keep our advantage in networking in the enterprise, and what we do is servers. We're going to make these servers, and the other thing about these servers, they're not only small, you can fit enough of these in a rack that a normal size server would take 8 racks, so it's space efficient as well. Now, you can't do high level scientific stuff on this stuff, but you can do web servers, and that's what the Facebooks and the Googles of the world are trying to do. So I think this is really smart for HP, and probably good news for HP stockholders, although the stock doesn't seem to be reacting necessarily exactly that way. Google wants to buy something up, and it's WhatsApp. What's up with buying WhatsApp, iOS?
Yeah, this is a strange story. Like I mentioned, the news Digital Trends is saying that Google wants to acquire WhatsApp for about $1 billion. WhatsApp is a messaging app that runs on lots of platforms, including Android, iOS, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone. And it's effectively an SMS replacement. You can send text messages, instant messages, images, videos, audio to each other if you're on the application. Digital Trends says that WhatsApp processed 18 billion messages on New Year's Eve 2012 alone. And the fee structure for WhatsApp is relatively interesting. On the iPhone, you pay $1 for the application and you can use it forever. For the other phone types, though, WhatsApp is free to download and try for the first year, and then they charge you $1 per year after that. And Google obviously already has a ton of different services, including Google Voice, Google Talk, Google Messenger, Google Hangouts, and I think they even own Meebo at this point. Ewan, what would Google even need another communications tool for? What makes sense for WhatsApp?
Users. I think they've got absolutely no need for the tech whatsoever. I mean, from what I understood, WhatsApp does, I think you could probably get a couple of smart engineers and sit them down for 2 weeks and have the equivalent same thing. I think what they bring is users. That's where the money is. That's where the outlet is for Google. The only thing I would say is that if you're trying to get someone from a walled environment like WhatsApp, where people are there because it's cool and it's new and it's different and fulfills their functions, and then you start trying to lever and crank them into the Googleverse, I think people would react and go, well, I want something else. I want to go elsewhere and look for this. They won't be able to just buy this, rebadge it, and expect people to stay there. It'll have to stay as it currently is. But it's users. It's not tech, I don't think.
Sarah, do you think that there would be a backlash if Google picked this company up? It seems like it's a function. Why would that change anything?
I don't think Google cares. I mean, when Facebook bought Instagram, people went, oh, no, Instagram is going to change. And it really hasn't. And it was just the same kind of thing. Instagram was up and coming, had a huge user base. Facebook paid a lot of money for it. I think it's the same idea here. I mean, 18 billion messages on New Year's Eve? Think about that for a second. This is a very popular app. That makes a lot of sense for Google. Yeah, Google's got its own services that, you know, are in some ways competitors to WhatsApp. But this is Google, you know, this is like a land grab for the cool services, right? There are quite a few of them now. They've got huge user bases, and Google wants that.
Tom, can you see this being a defensive move at all? Are there any companies that should be looking at this? I believe that WhatsApp was started by two guys who used to work at Yahoo.
Yeah, I think Ewan's right. It's users. I think also you want engineers, and you got some smart engineers, so it could be an acqui-hire element to it as well. And I think it is a defensive move. I think Google, and maybe a bit of an offensive move too. Remember, we talked last week about the rising tide of these messenger apps kind of taking over social networking space from the likes of Facebook and Twitter. Now, Google really wants you to get into Google Plus. I mean, that's why they killed Google Reader, is because they really want to put all their stuff into social networking, into Google Plus. It makes sense to me from that aspect to say, let's buy WhatsApp and let's take what they've learned and take that juice and direct it towards Google Plus. And that's why what Ewan's saying makes sense, which is we're going to direct those users towards Google Plus. Whether it work or not, I don't know. But WhatsApp is a very popular messenger app. And if Google can get on top of that and actually have that as a brand that they continue to make popular, they're ahead of a trend for once instead of falling behind.
if Google does acquire this, I hope they don't mess it up too badly. When they bought Grand Central and they made it into Google Voice, they stripped out a ton of functionality. They went with that flat Google styling. I used to use Grand Central back when it was Grand Central, and it was great. And then Google Voice was kind of cruddy. If Google's going to bother to do this, they should really do this before they unify all of their services, because there was that rumor a while ago that Google Babble is coming, this thing that's going to unify Talk, Messenger, Voice, all this stuff, all in one thing. So if they're going to bother to merge everything, grab as many other companies as you want to go into this new product, because if they introduce Babbel and then they have another thing that's outside of it, that's a big mistake. Although they both use XMPP, they should be able to talk to each other. So maybe if Google can just get Talk to work with WhatsApp, to work with everything else, I think that might be a good position.
All right, let's finish up with a new suitor for Hulu. As we've been following, Hulu's really showing some leg out there, trying to get interest. Peter Chernin, who architected Hulu when he was COO of News Corp, he was one of the main hands. He was on the board of Hulu saying, let's figure this out. Then he left News Corp. Now he's saying, hey, $500 million enough for you? Apparently, Hulu wants $2 billion, so there's a lot of space between those two bids. But Chernin has mused publicly about how someone might create an online-only competitor to HBO, and that would seem to be a great thing if he could get it at a price that made sense for him, is to snap up Hulu and start doing what Netflix has been doing, which is making an online competitor to HBO by having high-quality original programming. And Hulu already does some of that, absolutely. But they could really throw their weight and make that their big thing. Then the licensing of all the content doesn't become as important. However, that's why he only wants to pay $500 million, is he doesn't think he has the licensing deals to make it worth $2 billion. So there may be some wiggle room there to say, give me more licensing deals, I'll pay you more for this. I know we were talking beforehand, you're like, I don't even get Hulu. But you get Netflix, you get Love Film in the UK. Over in Scandinavia, they have HBO online only. So the trend is right now for a lot of companies to be creating these online only components that maybe start by bringing in existing television programs, but are also creating their own television programs that you can only get through these services. Do you think that something like this could work if an independent company came in, or an independent guy like Chernin came in and bought the service?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Netflix over here, we get that, and House of Cards and Lilyhammer and that kind of stuff has gone down great guns. And the beauty of that system is, instead of having to wait every week for something to come out, it's just blah, these 13 episodes, wade through them as much as you want, at the speed that you want. I think the thing with Hulu, though, is that there was a prospective IPO for them a couple of years ago that estimated them at $2 billion, and I reckon there's going to be they had a scheduled IPO probably in the next 12 months. And I think the Facebook thing has kind of shocked them a little bit, and they don't think they're going to go for what they think they're going to go for. So I think they're looking to try and maybe get someone in at the ground level to do more with them and probably get the best bang for their buck that they possibly can, and then float maybe in a few more years if that really does come up.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, if you're talking about the valuation at $500 million, you know, they're turning over $600-700 million a year anyway. So that still seems a little bit light, but they aren't a $2 billion business with the amount of debt they're carrying.
Well, the other interesting thing is that $2 billion valuation was used for Providence Equity to buy themselves out a couple of years ago, or I guess just last year, for $200 million, and they took that $200 million and they invested it in Peter Chernin's foundation. So, does Providence Equity know something here? Is this a bet on their part? What do you think is going on here, Ayaz?
Well, I think Hulu's just trying to figure out what it's going to do with itself. After it lost its CEO and they have a new guy coming in, they have to find their way. And Hulu's had such a contentious relationship with its owners. It's been a really strange thing going there. I know that News Corp apparently wants to go more towards the Hulu Plus style, where everything is pay. ABC and Disney, they want things to be more like it is now. It's a lot more free streaming, and then you have the value add of Hulu Plus. I just think that all the conflicts going on above the actual content is causing so many problems that a $500 million bid might just simply be like, hey, look, I'll take this company, I'll clear everything up, and you don't have to worry about this stuff anymore, because the relationships that exist right now are kind of messy.
Now, the other thing is Chernin worked very closely with Jason Kilar. And when Chernin left, a lot of people feel like that's when things started to go downhill for Jason Kilar. And that was one of the things that led to him leaving as CEO. Sarah, do you think that that also could be something where Chernin and Kilar have planned to re-team up on an independent Hulu somehow?
Yeah, maybe. They certainly seem to have a close relationship, so that would make sense. I think it just kind of turns into it's $500 million too lowballed is just not going to make sense. I mean, if you factor in the fact that you've got licensing rights, you've got $300 million in debt that has to be dealt with, then all of a sudden the price starts to look a little bit more attractive. I'm just interested in seeing how this would change the Hulu experience for people who are paying for Hulu Plus. I do. Hulu Plus is really good for certain shows, but it's also really limited. And it's you could think of Hulu and Netflix get lumped together as sort of similar services, but they're not really. It's yeah. Different. And, in many ways, there is not anything about Hulu that that certain people want to pay for, because a lot of it is, network television, or you already have a cable connection. Netflix has got original programming that's really, really working. House of Cards, of course, is the most obvious example of something that's like universally loved by everyone. Hulu's got original stuff too, and I'd be interested to see how that expands down the road, because I assume that they're working on it.
Do you think the issue with the difference between Hulu that you're talking about there, Sarah, between Hulu and Netflix is the business model style of the two companies, whereas you've got Netflix that is charging a very small amount for an incredibly good service that's got loads of old stuff, but great, if you're stuck bedridden on a Saturday afternoon with a cold or something, it's good to flick through, find something that you watched in the 70s or 80s and you're happy. Whereas Hulu is owned by the big corporations, it's owned by the Disneys, who aren't going to go, let's just give it away, free or reduced price, just to get people watching, just to get people interested. These people are hardened business, want a return, want it now, whereas Netflix is more of an egalitarian business model.
Yeah, Sarah, were you asking that of Sarah, or is that just an open...
Anyone, just an open question, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Sarah's point about the differences.
Yeah, I think that what I would like to see in a new owner is focus on Hulu, because I'm still puzzled on what I get when I pay and what I get when I don't pay. And I've continued to keep my Hulu subscription on pause because of that. And I never seem to really need to get anything. On the other hand, they've got some great stuff on there. For instance, The Booth at the End, which I believe started as a Canadian show, and then Hulu picked it up and kept it going. Online is a great show. So if they had a little more budget, a little more oomph behind them, the way Netflix has done with Arrested Development, House of Cards, Lilyhammer, I'd love to see what Hulu would do as an independent when they were out from under the thumb of their corporate sponsor.
Wait, did you just say that you don't really get what you get extra if you pay for Hulu Plus versus just use Hulu?
Yeah, I keep my Hulu subscription on pause and I never have to take it off.
But how, if you were to watch Hulu programming, how would you watch it? Just via your browser?
A browser and then AirPlay it.
All right. Yeah. Well, fine.
Let's move on to the randomizer. Liquid Robotics has launched a new generation of wave glider ocean robots. They've been doing this for a while, apparently, which is news to me. It's pretty awesome. These wave gliders have floated more than 9,000 miles across the Pacific Ocean, totally self-guided. They have sensors. They do a lot of research. They usually use wave energy for propulsion and solar power for sensors and communications. But now the new ones can actually use solar power for propulsion as well, meaning that extends the range of them. We hear a lot about drones flying through the air. I haven't heard about wave gliders out there doing research before. Have any of you guys?
Nope. First I've heard of it.
It's pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
Just an army of robots.
So we've got these guys. We've got these things just going independent on their own. We've got those robot jellyfish things we saw last week.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean's just going to be full of our robots, and the fish are going to be scared.
I think the thing that you've got with this is the... didn't they do a circumnavigation of the globe with an autonomous boat just last year? It had taken it 16 months or something like that.
No kidding. Really? All the way around?
I think so. I've just got that in the back of my head. I don't know facts to back that up. But I think the problem that you've got with drones is and autonomous vehicles is the fact that you're going to need some seriously good legislation for these soon, because there's so many out there that, I mean, there was someone saying that one of the Al-Qaeda websites, sympathiser websites, had got plans on how to make a drone on it. You know, everyone has got a drone. Everyone can buy drones, and they're easily made, easily flown, and they could become a menace soon.
Yeah. On the other hand, using these for research on the ocean seems like it could be a good thing. I don't know. It's weird stuff.
Drone wars, matter of time.
Will be.
War on the seven seas.
Wave Navy. Let's see what's on the calendar.
All right. All right. Starting on Monday, April 8th, sites all across the web are actually joining what they're calling a week of action. This is the Internet Defense League, which is the same groups that were actively fighting against SOPA to fix the CFAA. If you're interested, you can go to fixthecfaa.com for more information. AdTech, the conference starts tomorrow, runs through Wednesday in San Francisco. BlackRock Shooter, the game, is heading to PlayStation on April 23rd. Namco Bandai has revealed, this is through the game's official website, that June 5th is the official release date of the 3DS game Project X Zone. This is a strategy RPG crossover. So you've got characters from Namco Bandai's games as well as Sega and Capcom. Should make some folks happy as well. Again, that's June 25th.
Excellent. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got a caller who sees Facebook Home's potential tracking as familiar. Caller, explain.
Hey, guys. Just wanted to make a quick comment on the story of Facebook Home on episode 726. Sarah had a comment about Facebook learning your home and other aspects about you, but Google Now does this actually very well and found out where I live, where I worked, and gave me the stock quote of the company I worked for just after a couple days. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Yeah, I think, I think we talked about the fact that clearly Facebook is not tapping into technology that other companies don't have access to. It's just that there's a Facebook reputation to contend with, right? People tend to trust Facebook perhaps less than Google. I don't know. It depends on the person, right?
I don't know, I like Google Now knowing what I'm doing. Like, they should be figuring things out for me anyway. That's maybe why I'm not so scared of Facebook Home.
It's completing your sentences after a while, too.
I like that. It's like, I think it's cool, too. My soulmate. Anyway, we've got to...
It is kind of perception, right? People have not got a good perception of Facebook protecting privacy. And I'm not saying they have a great perception of Google, but it certainly isn't as bad. Facebook's the one that everyone always thinks of as invading your privacy. So, yeah, I mean, these are very similar things. But one of them people tout and say, oh, yeah, no, that's a great thing. It knows exactly where I am at all times. That's not creepy.
We got an email from Tony from Albany. He says, hey, TNT crew, I was listening to Friday's episode where you discussed game companies requiring internet access to play games such as SimCity, as well as the speculation that the new Xbox might require it. The issue I have not heard anyone discuss that really bothers me is the question of how long a game will be supported. Maybe I'm missing something, but what if the unthinkable happens and EA goes out of business, for example? Or does a game company decide to shut down servers to save money when only a handful of people are playing in some number of years they consider a reasonable lifetime? Is there some kind of failsafe to this kind of internet copy protection that I'm not aware of? That's a really interesting point. What happens when the servers shut down?
Hackers. Well,
you're only renting the game anyway.
There you go. That's the new reality.
It's licensing. So it's you're licensed to use it as long as they say you're licensed to use it. If they remove that license, bad luck.
Maybe this will bring back board games. Just it never is offline. Actually, it's always offline and it's always available.
Always off.
Hey, man. Tabletop games haven't gone away. They're bigger than ever. It's just maybe this will give them a boost.
You have to pick on the box. No subscription fee needed for checkers.
Yeah, exactly. New marketing campaign. All right. Well, that is all for us today. Ewan Rankin, thank you so much. I hope your back held up well through this.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm okay. It's when I get up.
Notice a twinge. So hope you're on the mend quick. Let folks know about British Tech Network and what they can find there. It's great stuff over there.
Yeah, we've been going for over a year now. We had the Bagel Tech before that, but we've got 8 shows each week. We've got Photo Show, Big Show, which you're on regularly, and the Mac Show, which Andy and that goes on, and plenty of others. Jeff Gamet comes on regularly. Photo Show, Gamer Show, iOS Show. We've got 8 shows running each week, and it's just mates sitting around having a chat, just chewing the cud over the general tech news and specific news, and enjoy it. BritishTechNetwork.com.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on there as much as you have. It's really fun hanging out with you guys.
No, we love you coming on. It's great. The idea of the shows is to relax, enjoy, and just talk like you're down the pub, and the people that are listening are just eavesdroppers.
BritishTechNetwork.com. Don't forget also you can submit stories in our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. Let folks know what stories you'd like us to cover. Maybe even vote on the stories that other people, in fact, not maybe, do it. Go vote on those stories that other people have submitted, technewstoday.reddit.com. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. And give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow with Raj Diyut as our guest. See you then.